I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen.
All right, welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Patrick Antonetti. This week, it is a regular on this podcast. It is John Orand of the Sports Business Daily. He is their media writer. He is a writer for the Sports Business Journal. And he also has a great newsletter that he does with Michael Smith that if you're a Sports Business Daily reader, make sure you sign up for. It's really good. John, not only does he get really interesting stories and reporting in there, he lets you know just how powerful he is when it comes to interacting with the movers and shakers of the sports media landscape. And John Orand joins us on the Sports Media Podcast. John, how are you?
I'm a man about town, Richard.
Yeah, John, I'm a little under the weather here, so I'm not going to be as quick as you today. You have a big advantage in terms of sharpness and quality of your volleys and responses. So we're counting on you to carry this podcast is really what I'm saying.
that's trouble. That's trouble right there.
All right. So let's start off, John, with the NFL viewership. There's a lot of stories you could always sort of lead with, but to me, I think that's the most interesting one on my mind right now, because the NFL in week one, they had a great week, John. The viewership numbers are finally in. And Monday Night Football in particular was way up year over year in terms of viewers and obviously overnights. Fox's game, Giants-Cowboys game, and that window was up, even though I think the concurrent game the year before was a better game. Most of the pregame shows were up. The first game of the season, the Sunday Night Football Thursday game was up. So, the interesting thing to me is that viewership was up, even though there were some blowouts in, key games. Steelers-Patriots was a dud. Giants-Cowboys was not very good. The Browns were a mess against the Titans. So how do you, very open-ended, how do you view it? What do you view off week one viewership?
Well, it's funny. Sometimes we get grief for spending too much time talking about TV ratings. But I can tell you, we had a Sports Business Journal about a month before kickoff. We had a big roundtable where we had network executives, we had sponsors, we had league executives, team executives, and we asked them what the biggest storylines that they were looking for going into this season. And every single person mentioned TV ratings, that the league is fixated and focused on ratings. They don't want to see ratings go down. And so it's a very, in terms of sports business and in terms of what I cover, TV ratings is a really big issue for them. And I got to say, coming out of week one, there are better case scenarios. But if you're the NFL and you're looking at these games that were not competitive by and large, especially in some of the bigger windows, and they still saw substantial gains, they have to be, I happen to know that they are like thrilled by it. And they just think that this is something that is going to build throughout the season. Always hard on week one to take a look at it, but if week one is any indication, it's going to be a pretty good season for the NFL.
All right, John, so let's get into the whys. My thesis doesn't mean I'm right or wrong as to why this exists, and I think Mike Mulvihill, one of your buddies at Fox Sports, I think agrees with me here. And a lot of this has to do, John, in my opinion, with offense and quarterbacks. The league is marketed by quarterbacks. It's always been marketed by quarterbacks, Brady versus Brees and Manning versus Brady. And, now it's Mahomes versus Wentz. You can market quarterbacks nationally because you don't necessarily have to be in that particular city to be a fan of that quarterback or interested in that quarterback. So they have a very, I think, really good group of quarterbacks, particularly young quarterbacks. Two, the rules have been set up to produce more offense, and the offensive numbers in the league go up. And again, offense really, I think, sells the sport more than defense. Last year in particular, there were some great games, very, very competitive games. And I think obviously that helped. I think, you know, you continue to sort of just go deeper into the factors. The home experience continues to be that much greater in terms of watching the game. It's great to watch on TV. I would think sports gambling has a little bit of a factor. I don't know if that's, you necessarily draw the line from sports gambling, more legalization to added viewership, but I think maybe that will come. And it does feel like, and again, this is pure anecdotal, that more people are into fantasy football this year than maybe in the last couple of years. I could be wrong about that. That's my thought, at least very early. And again, it's only week one as to why viewership was up. And then lastly, John, and again, I should just mention this, the college football numbers are way up. So it does seem like Americans, for whatever reason, this September, there was kind of a thirst for football, because it's not just the NFL that's up, but college is way up too.
You know, and we keep talking about ratings being up. It's important sometimes to take a step back and say ratings for television in general are falling like a stone. And so this is really unusual. You know, there's a cliche in TV now, flat is the new up. Well, NFL ratings and, like you said, college ratings are actually going up. So it's especially impressive in terms of that. I mean, you hit on most of the things. I think that, you know, every year I ask John McManus over at CBS. I think you appreciate that name drop right there, Richard. But
yes, that was nice.
Yeah, I try to put those in pretty obliquely. Anyway, I ask him about like why what he's looking for, and he always talks about storylines. And I think that going into this NFL season, there are a lot of storylines that are going beyond you know, hardcore football fans. I think, you know, what's happened in Cleveland, they have to start winning, but you know, all of the excitement and everything around Cleveland has really captured some casual fans or even some non-fans. I think, you know, having the Patriots in this sort of dominant team is something that always increases ratings. You know, true fans might not like it. They might like a little bit more parity. But when you have a team of a decade, or with the Patriots, team of two decades, you know, still on top and beating people in prime time by you know, several touchdowns, you know, people tune into that. So there are a lot of storylines that are out there. You said the quarterback play. A lot of the storylines revolve around the quarterback play as well. And one thing that I'm hearing a lot more, and I think it's because Fox is in the gambling game, but you're going to hear a lot from Fox. And they think that gambling is really increasing ratings in those markets where gambling has been legalized. And so they take a look at New Jersey and in Pennsylvania, to sort of, you know, big East Coast states, high population centers, and ratings are up even more so in those states than otherwise. So they think that as legalized gambling gets rolled out a little bit more, it doesn't necessarily mean that more people are going to be watching it, but it means that the people that are watching it and are gambling are going to be tuned in for longer. And so it's like Al Michaels at the end of a Sunday Night Football game talking about, like, who's still watching a blowout. You know, those are the people, and that's what advertisers and the NFL and the networks really want.
John, what kind of importance do you place on certain teams this year having good years? The Browns have... they have multiple national windows left. I don't know if it's 4 or 5. It strikes me that the league needs the Steelers to be pretty good given national windows. I don't have it in front of me, but, you know, usually the New York teams sort of have national windows even when the New York teams are not great. And then for sure they need the Bears to do well, given that it's the, you know, it's a top 5 market, and you know, you're just dealing with sort of a sheer number of people who could watch out of Chicago. But off the top of your head, obviously to me, I feel like Browns, Steelers, Bears, very, very key teams for the NFL this year. The Cowboys, I think, will be good. The Eagles will be good. So they're going to have some, you know, big television teams that are going to be good. But so often I feel like you can really have a good year in aggregate or overall if some of these sort of big market or teams that have national windows have good years.
Yeah, there are teams like you mentioned, the Cowboys, the Packers, and now the Patriots, and I think you mentioned Philadelphia as well. They're all 1-0. They all looked good. Well, the Packers not necessarily, but they're all 1-0, and there's some optimism, and that always helps. But if you talk to TV executives, they point to Chicago and the Bears, and they think that the increase that in ratings that they saw last season was a factor of the Bears actually playing well for the first time in several years. The Pittsburgh Steelers, you know, they've been pretty good for a pretty long time. And so they didn't look good on Sunday night. So there's a little bit of angst there because the Steelers are a national brand, and the Steelers being good will help TV ratings. I'm not sure if the Browns fall into that. The Browns, there's a lot of interest around the Browns, and I know that they have a bunch of, I think it's four primetime games coming up in the rest of the season. But you know, every season there's like a team that comes in with a lot of hype, and I think they hope they do well because there's a lot of hype, there's a lot of characters, there's a lot of storylines around that team. But if they don't, Cleveland isn't a market that the TV networks necessarily depend on.
Yeah, they sent Romo and Nance, CBS did.
Yeah, surprised by that decision, weren't you?
No, I wasn't actually, because I think that the Browns are far and away the winners of the preseason in terms of interest, in terms of hype. They have a lot of great offensive skill players. And I've always thought that, and again, pure anecdotally, but I think there's a lot more Browns fans in the country than I think your average NFL fan realizes. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that they were such a great team, John, in like the 50s and 60s. And I do think some of that fandom, you know, carried over generationally, where people then moved out of Cleveland and probably stuck with them. They have been so bad for so long that maybe some fans sort of moved on to different teams. But it doesn't surprise me because I feel like if they're good, they're going to be a significant team of interest, just given, you know, Mayfield and Landry and Chubb and OBJ. So it did not surprise me that Nance and Romo started there. What did surprise me was the quality of the game. I actually watched that game. I wrote about that for my Athletic column, and it was
a great first series for the Browns.
Yeah, exactly. The first series was unbelievable, and then after that,
You know, on top of that, my wife is from Cleveland, so I've been going to Cleveland a couple times a year for the past 30 years or so, and it's a sports market, and when those teams do well, that city back you could see it today this year in the baseball All-Star game. That city, it's a big Midwestern city. You see the same thing in St. Louis. I think you see the same thing in Detroit. Even if those teams start to get good, they back these teams and support them. So you said generational. That's exactly what it feels like.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right, John, let's talk about college football.
This is my chance to talk about Maryland, right? 2-0?
Yes. There's no reporter in the sports media space that Fox likes more than John Orand. I think we've established that, given your newsletter.
And open so, for business, guys. Open for business.
No kidding. Man, talk about the you don't need to go to Starbucks to get lattes at the Orand Mansion. All right. So so here's the thing, and I give Fox a lot of credit for this. I mean, how I don't know if they've monetized it. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, that's what it's about. But their early kickoff strategy has worked so far. And what that early kickoff strategy is that Fox made a decision to essentially put their best game, or at least one of their best games, in the noon Eastern time window, assign Gus Johnson, Joel Klatt, Jenny Taft, their first team, those games, and then try to, yeah, let's face it, sort of swipe some audience from ESPN and ABC during the day in that window. They have had Ohio State and Michigan over the first 2 weeks. Those are great television teams, maybe the two best with Alabama in the country in terms of sort of a national brand. And they've destroyed the year-over-year numbers from the year before. I mean, like, you know, crazy, 50%, 70-something percent. Very helped for sure by a great Michigan, I shouldn't say a great Michigan Army game, but a close Michigan Army game that people were paying attention to. So, John, it strikes me that at least one of the stories, at least early in the year, is that Fox's early sort of kickoff schedule has worked. I do want to get to big noon kickoff because I probably think of that show a little differently than others. But let's just take college football to start. One, Fox at the Eastern time seems like they're doing great. And then secondly, ESPN ABC's numbers, and I know they front-loaded their schedule, but they've been great so far. I mean, that LSU-Texas number was unbelievable for a September game.
Yeah, I think the Fox's strategy is that they want to win the noon window sort of bigger than anybody else wins any other window. And so they're not going to get as many viewers generally at noon as you would in prime time, I would think. But they felt that there are so many there's so much more competition in prime time. There's more competition in late afternoon. I mean, that's generally the CBS SEC package. That's always the highest rated on television in there. But generally, noon was sort of like, you had college game day on ESPN leading into a blah game, just games that didn't carry any sauce with it, so to speak. And so they wanted to really front load and just take over that window. And that would be their big window. I think that it was a pretty safe bet to make, to be honest, because if you take a look at last year, they had a lot of really good games in that noon window. And if you take a look at some of the contracts that they have with these college conferences, like Michigan, Ohio State, that's going to kick off at noon all the time. So they can't move their biggest game to prime time no matter what. Right. The Big Ten really wants a lot of their marquee games to kick off at noon. That's, part of what they do. So with Fox, they sort of saw that and were like, well, let's then market the noon for being our biggest one. And then let's just do it every week. We'll take the best game and put it there. Cause they ended up having, I think last year, if you look, they probably had the best game at noon, maybe two or three times already. So it wasn't that much of a stretch to just say, we're going to do it a little bit more, but it certainly does seem to be working.
John, how much have you watched the Fox new college football pregame show that is competing against College Game Day? Have you watched Big Noon Kickoff with Rob Stone, Urban Meyer, Reggie Bush, Matt Leinart, Brady Quinn?
This is where I should lie and say that I've sat down and watched everything, but I actually haven't sat down to watch it yet. I'm looking forward to doing it at some point, probably this weekend, but I haven't actually watched it. I have read a lot of reviews on it, but I haven't actually sat down and watched.
Okay, well we will return to that at a different date because I'm interested.
But you have. I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Richard?
I have. And well, let's do twofold. One, let's take the sort of the viewership of it. I think Fox has sort of realistic expectations that they're never going to beat College Game Day, but I do think they want
never being this year or next year. But who knows?
John, take the Terry Hines glasses off. They're not beating College Game Day ever.
The Big Noon Kickoff ratings before Michigan, Ohio State will get eerily close to College Game Day. They'll be very
maybe.
Close.
I'm talking about for the entire year. I mean,
okay, yeah, of course you're right for the entire season.
Yeah, I mean, John, no, we could try. Me and you, we're not going to be Brad Pitt. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, you can come close, you can get great plastic surgery, but that's not happening. But yes, I agree with you on that particular week. I think they will come as close as they come. So what I was going to say, well, it wasn't necessarily a knock on Fox. It's that I think both from the initial first two weeks of viewership, I think both have to be happy. I mean, College Game Day has beaten them essentially like in terms of overnight. I think it was like a 1-7 to an 0-7 or a 1-6 to an 0-6. I apologize if I'm off on this. But, I mean, a significant win. But if you're Fox, this is all gravy to me because you didn't have any kind of pregame presence last year. So you're gaining new audience. That's the way I look at it. People are sampling your product at 11 a.m. And if you're College Game Day, you got to be psyched. I think you were up in your ratings like the last couple of weeks, and you're still, you're still clearly the most popular pregame show. The question about content, that's one I would like to talk to you about because I'd like you to see it and get a sense. I think if in situations where Urban Meyer is used as kind of an X's and O's expert or sort of explaining to you the intricacies of the game, I think, listen, there are very few college football coaches who have his resume and have his intelligence. And I think that's been really, really interesting. I think Brady Quinn is a pretty smart guy, and I appreciate his insights there. My problem, John, with that show is I don't believe Urban Meyer just as a broadcaster. I cannot take what is coming out of his mouth outside of X's and O's with any kind of transparency. So I'm colored in my view by that for that whole show. Outside of that, I think the show is fine. I don't think it's revolutionary. It's certainly acceptable to watch, or it'll give you, at least when it comes to the Big Ten, a nice little, or at least Fox's game, sort of a nice little setup of what's coming up at that game. It's very different than College Game Day. They're in the studio. They have no kind of atmosphere. So that's a big difference. But I think it's a, you know, I'm not trying to be mundane here. I think it's a perfectly acceptable, perfectly average pregame show with the potential to get better. And if you're Fox, I think you got to be psyched about that. It's not a bomb by any means. I'm not sure it's a mega hit at this point, but, you know, I think they have something to work with. But I'm not going to be the viewer here because I having covered Urban Meyer at ESPN and written about what went down there, I'd be honest with you, I just don't believe the guy. So it's hard for me to watch that show and take him as an honest broker when it comes to college football. That's about as honest as I can be with that.
Do you feel that there's a breakout star among those four that are on the set?
Yeah, Meyer is going to be the breakout star because the show revolves around him in the same way the Fox baseball show revolves around A-Rod, you know, in the same way they tried to really highlight Pete Rose. I mean, it's very clear the producers are making that sort of Urban Meyer show. And then if you're talking about outside of that, who has a chance to break out? I actually thought Leinart was very, very good in the weeks that I've seen. I would think, though, that it seems like they're going to really push Brady Quinn on that in addition to Urban. But Urban's the star of the show. That the show is, they believe that they have an A-Rod like figure in Urban Meyer when it comes to college football. And so I don't even think if I was a producer, that's not the worst strategy because like he's the most famous guy on the set. So you should really build it around him.
What I find interesting is that you have, you know, in Urban Meyer, Brady Quinn, Reggie Bush, you have people that are, you know, have played college football recently. And I think that's something that Fox is really going to start to push a little bit as opposed to, you know, I love Lee Corso and I love it when he puts on, the mascot head. I mean, that's must see TV at the end of game day. But I think that they will try to compare contrast in that sense as they start to feel their oats and go up against game day a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, no offense, John, but it's not like, Brady Quinn, Reggie Bush played yesterday. I mean, compared to Corso. Yeah. But we're still talking
compared to
almost
Herb
15
Street,
years
maybe, right?
for those guys. Well, yeah, I mean, Corso played with Burt Reynolds. I mean, you know, you're not going to. That's a long time ago. So, yeah, I hear you on that. But, you know, Desmond Howard, Kirk Herbstreit, David Pollack, those guys aren't necessarily right off the field. This is where they have an advantage with Urban Meyer.
I'm feeling a battle of the network stars coming up between the two college football pregame shows. That would
Fox would kill if they have. You know, between Reggie and I feel like Brady Quinn, although David Pollack's he's in amazing shape, great athlete. All right, anyway, as we finish up here, I was really, really impressed, John, by ESPN's tennis numbers. You know I'm a big tennis fan. And so they had a phenomenal tournament in terms of viewership. Most watched U.S. Open since 2015. Bianca Andreescu's Serena Williams match, most watched match of the tournament, I think second most watched U.S. Open match in the history of ESPN. I want to say behind like an Agassi Federer or Federer Djokovic or something. But they had phenomenal numbers, John. Again, maybe it's a one-off when it comes to this particular tournament, but I was really impressed because you don't often see tennis pop, but for whatever reason, it popped during this tournament.
It's exactly what we were talking about with the NFL, too. It's the same thing takes hold. You had stars. You had Nadal and you had Serena Williams playing well. You had storylines. God, I'm going to blank on his name. Who was the villain on the men's side? Richard.
Daniil Medvedev.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, he started that earlier in the tournament and went straight through and kept winning so that people wanted to watch in there. So he had storylines and stars, and, you know, it worked out. That's what brings ratings. It's not a big surprise.
Yeah, and again, we'll see if, you know, one of the things, Serena will always draw viewership for ESPN. That's not going to change. The question will be, can some of these young stars like Bianca, Coco Gauff, et cetera, can they sort of maintain an audience as ESPN continues to broadcast tennis. So that's.
But even more than just the TV audience, that men's final was as loud. I think John McEnroe said it. He was that's as loud as he's ever heard in a tennis tournament, which was an impressive statement, I thought.
John, do you have any thoughts on the Antonio Brown coverage? In any way, I did a lot of this in the Monday media column that I have. My sort of one overarching thought when it comes to this is, it really is invaluable to have voices, if you're serious about covering this stuff, to have one, some legal voices on television to discuss the legalities of this, and, you know, whether it's like a Michael McCann type at SI or back in the day, Lester Munson, Roger Cossack at ESPN. And then secondly, and again, this is so biased on my part because she's a longtime friend, but this is one of those weeks where ESPN really misses Jane McManus, who is somebody who was an accomplished reporter on sexual assault in relation to professional sports and could speak in the language of this kind of stuff and offer, I think, some kind of nuance and some kind of reporting when it comes to how this stuff is covered. And, you know, ESPN will always be able to cover the football side of it, but that's where I think someone like a Jane McManus is missed. And I will say this, and it's very important to say this. ESPN, historically speaking, is the only one who even cares about that kind of stuff. Fox has never had like a Jane McManus type on its airwaves. CBS, NBC, et cetera, they're just going to cover the pregame stuff, you know, the Antonio Browns playing for the Patriots, not playing for the Patriots, et cetera. But that was my sort of one overarching stuff, you know, when it comes to the complainant that filed against Antonio Brown. The football stuff's always going to be covering, and it's almost like very easy for these pregame shows to do. You know, Fox lit up Antonio Brown. It's pretty easy to do. I'm not saying they're wrong. Mike Greenberg called it, whatever, the most unprofessional thing he's ever seen in professional sports. A ridiculously nonsense take, but, you know, that's very easy for those kind of shows to do. The harder thing is to do what the Jane McManus types do.
Yeah, I got to say, just as a consumer of reading it, like I, when you talk about having a legal voice in there, that's sort of what I want to hear. And you mentioned Jane McManus speaking in that language. I mean, too many people. I'm not going to do a stick to sports or stay in your lane, but too many people just kind of were like popping off at nothing. Nobody, I mean, there was a filing and an allegation and then counter allegation. And, you know, I just want to, what I wanted to see as a consumer, and I'm not covering this, but I wanted to see legally what was up. I mean, what does all this mean? And then somebody that's sort of steeped in reporting on sexual assault and to sort of talk about, you know, what was going on. But having, you know, First Take or, you know, Get Up talk about this is that would demand that I change the channel immediately. I mean, I'm not sitting down to watch their opinions on what they don't know about.
Yeah, but you know, again, it's people will watch at least, you know, the usual 400,000 or whatever those kind of shows will get. And yeah, again, I can't. Again, it's sort of a hometown pick here, but I cannot recommend like somebody like Michael McCann, who writes cogently and smartly about all this intersection of sports and criminality. Somebody like Jessica Luther, when it comes to sexual assault and professional athletics. If you really want to be educated on this stuff, that's really who to hit on. It's not to say that ESPN can't do it. And, you know, obviously the outside the lines types, they can pull that off. But that's, you know, at least in my experience, I find you're going to have to go to the print digital end to really get insight into this as opposed to television. All right, two last things, John. One, interesting note by you. Michelle Wee will be joining the Golf Channel's coverage of the Solheim Cup. You'll probably be listening to this. Some of you, Michelle Wee, will have done this already. But that's interesting because I feel like given her star power, John, and given her name recognition, again, I think she's obviously going to golf for a while. She's still pretty young. But that's somebody maybe who becomes a part of a golf coverage post-golf career. You know, she's got so much marketing sort of potential, just, you know what I mean, walking into the booth. Maybe the most famous women's golfer in America, at least by name.
You know what I found most interesting about that is that Golf Channel knew about her because they interviewed her and they know how well she performs on camera. But what Golf Channel's Molly Solomon said was it was her social media profile and it was her social media audience that really got them thinking about bringing her on because she's able to communicate with younger people and she just has a following that they hope will be able to translate. And I've been hearing that more and more. That isn't a completely new thing, but it just does cement that, you know, Twitter followers and Instagram followers are something that these TV producers really take a look at when they make talent decisions.
John, that's a great point. And I don't think there's any doubt whether that's good or not is a larger discussion that, you know, we'd have to have in a sociology forum. But there is no doubt that, and again, I'm not saying he's not talented because I think he's very talented, but somebody like Pat McAfee, John, part of the appeal for DAZN and ESPN and Westwood One and other places is his massive following on social media. And so I am with you on that. Again, I think he would have been hired regardless, but somebody like Ryan Russillo, who has immense loyalty and popularity on social media, you bring him into the Ringer, and it's going to increase your, you know, sort of podcast loyalty. It's interesting, John. We've been talking about social media and the media and the sports media for a long time. But the last year or so, I'm with you on this. I feel like from executives and other places, I've been hearing like the value of Instagram feeds or Twitter feeds or social media presence far more than I've ever heard before.
This has been happening for a while, but there seems to be almost a new emphasis that's been put on that. And sure enough, when Molly Solomon was talking about Michelle Wie, the first thing she mentioned wasn't, wow, she's really good on camera. It was her engagement on Twitter, or her engagement on actually not Twitter but Instagram, which again, it wasn't a big surprise, but it did confirm some stuff.
I actually think, John, my thought there is that in a universe of so much fragmentation and just really, everybody competing for audience, I think executives now see that as, you know, it's worth it to pay for somebody's social media following because maybe that gets you some new people under your tent. It's really, really interesting. And even at The Athletic, I mean, I think very, very clearly they have looked at people's social media feeds and following and engagement to bring in new audience. So it's extended everywhere. Is there anything else, John, that you wanted to? Oh, you know what, John? I will say this. We do like 1 minute on this. You happen to read Joe Drape's story on Justify and the Kentucky Derby?
No, I only saw the headlines.
Read it. What an awesome bit of reporting, basically, to get the details on Justify's positive drug test for a banned performance enhancer prior to the Kentucky Derby. I mean, that is an amazing bit of reporting. And, you know, it's not going to nearly get the attention it would if it was like, you know, some gold medalist, sort of finding out about some gold medalist. But a great piece of journalism or a great piece of reporting. So check Joe Drape's piece out. All right, John, is there anything you need to promote? I mean, are you going on any other podcasts? Are you doing any television appearances?
There's just one promotion. I'm not being paid for this, but I if you ever happen to find yourself in Janesville, Wisconsin, Richard, there are three bars there that I went to last week. A sports bar, a bar called Bazinga's, and a bar called Barclays. I highly recommend those three.
Unbelievable. That, John, that strikes me as bars that could be owned by an NBC Sports top communications chief. I mean, that's a guess off the top of my head.
Shout out to Greg Hughes. Greg Hughes was celebrating. Greg Hughes is a top communications executive at NBC Sports, and he was celebrating Barclays' fourth anniversary. I happened to be in Madison for the Wisconsin game, so he invited my brother and me over. We came, and we wrote about it in the SBJ Media newsletter, but it was a fun time just to hang out in a good old small town in Wisconsin.
Well, you get lattes from ESPN and the Ringer, and you get drinks from Greg Hughes, John. You're having
I'll do whatever I can get.
Quite a week. John, all right. John, as always, thank you. John Olrand is, we got to talk about wrestling one of these days, John, AEW and Fox doing SmackDown. I know that's not your favorite thing, but I'm fascinated by this. John O'Rand is a Sports Business Daily media writer. He also works for the Sports Business Journal. Check out the newsletter that I mentioned to him. He's probably will be doing podcasts as well for Sports Business Daily. And if you are interested in helping John's social media ranking get higher, he is Orand_SBJ on Twitter. John, always great to catch up with you. And I'm sure we will do this again probably in the next couple of weeks.
Hope so. Thanks, Artie.
All right, back in the studio. My thanks to John Orand. Always love catching up with him. If this is these conversations about the sports media, or if you like listening to interviews, last week was Booger McFarland. The week before that was Gus Johnson, Bruce Feldman, and Stuart Mandel. Before that, we did some talk on ESPN's NBA coverage and the future of women's sports coverage. So if you like this kind of stuff, please head to the Sports Media with Richard Deitch page. That's a Cadence 13 podcast. And give us a review. Please subscribe. And that's the way the podcast sticks around. My thanks to Patrick Antonetti, who did a lot of work this week on the back end of this podcast, in addition to producing it. Thanks to John McDermott, Chris Corcoran, Spencer Brown, everybody at Cadence 13. And again, head to the Apple Podcast page if you want to see the last couple of podcasts that we have done. As we head forward, probably some NFL-centric podcasts. And one special one coming up, if you're still listening to this podcast, Garrett Graff, who wrote an incredible piece on, wrote an incredible book, I should say, on what happened the day of 9/11. He interviewed, I think, more than 500 people and put together an incredible oral history that I believe the book is called The Only Plane in the Sky. It's basically an oral history of 9/11 with a real specific on what was going on Air Force One that day. Totally fascinating book. So he'll be on in the next couple of weeks to talk about that, even though it's a non-sports thing. All right. I'll talk to you guys soon. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Media Podcast.